Good morning, everybody. We know the story in the Chumash that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Adam HaRishon he's not permitted to eat from the Eitz Hadas. We always thought the pshat in the Chumash is that Adam HaRishon was told he's not permitted to eat from the Eitz Hadas. That's what it sounds like in the Chumash. So the Ramban quotes a Medrash, the first of the Marmikraimis, the Ramban in his commentary on the bottom of the Rif is called Melchemes Hashem. So he quotes a Medrash, Yilam Deinu is the other name for the Medrash Tanchuma, that if Adam HaRishon was created on Friday, and if he would have waited till Friday night, he would have been able to eat from the Eitz Hadas. He didn't have the gedult, he didn't have the patience to wait a few hours. So the Medrash says, Mi gala ofa meinecha Adam HaRishon. We wish someone could dig up Adam HaRishon and wipe off the sand from his eyes and show him, the Jewish people, that if a woman has to go to mikveh, so they have to wait a couple of days. And when we plant a tree, so we wait a few years till we're permitted to eat the fruits that grow the first 3 years, have a din of orlo. And then the Ramban quotes that when we shech the behemah, we don't eat right away. There's 70 different kinds of trephis, and we don't eat from the behemah until we check the lungs to see that there are no sirchas on the lungs. So the Ramban quotes this Medrash, and he wants to understand, why is it that we only check for sirchas on the lungs? There's so many other kinds of trephis. It would take hours and hours if we would have to check for everything. So the Ramban distinguishes that sirchas on the trephis, sirchas on the lungs, is what he calls a miut hamatzui. That's the Gemara says that rov behemos hakasheres, most of the animals when you shech them are kosher. You have to make sure you do a proper shechita, otherwise it's a prohibition of nevela. And even if you shech it properly, but if the animal is diseased, then it's considered a trefa. So there's so many different diseases and broken legs and broken lungs and broken ribs that one could check for. We don't bother to check for everything. We only check for the sirchas on the lungs because that's a miut hamotzei. This is the way it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch based on this Ramban number 2. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, it's not necessary, it's tzorach libdok achashum treifus min astam. Unless you know the animal fell down a flight of stairs, so then you have to be concerned, maybe one of the ribs broke and broke in the lungs. Okay, but under normal circumstances, you only have to check min astam. If nothing unusual happened to the animal, you only have to check for sirchus on the lungs, because this is a miut hamotzui. And the last line in the first of the Marmikaimus, the Ramban says, V'vadei shezu habdika midivrei. This requirement to check for the miut hamotzui is only midirabbanon. It's not a din min haTorah. That's what the Shach writes in number 3 of the Marmikaimus. When the Shulchan Aruch says that one who doesn't check for the sirchus on the lungs is poritz geder, he's doing something improper. If it's a real din min haTorah, that it's necessary to check when it's possible, when you have a miut hamotzei. So what do you just quote a pasuk? Poritz geder yishachenu nachash. One who's poritz geder deserves to be bitten by a snake. So the Shach writes, mashma de b'dika zume de rabbanon. As the Ramban said, the whole obligation to check by miut hamotzei is only mid rabbanon. This is very relevant, of course, in the slaughterhouses, that they only check for the sirchas on the lungs. And it's relevant also with respect to checking vegetables. Years ago in America, they permitted the farmers to spray pesticide on all of the vegetables. So it was very rare that you would find any bugs on any vegetables. But in recent years, already many years, governments don't permit to use pesticides anymore. So sometimes it's very common that you'll find bugs on the vegetables. So most of the time, let's say if you have a vegetable, it doesn't seem, without checking, doesn't look like there has any bugs. So strictly speaking, you could probably rely on the rov that it probably doesn't have any bugs. But if you have a miut hamotzui, if it's a significant minority possibility that it may have bugs, then the din would require that you have to check. What's the definition of a miut hamotzui? What percentage are we talking about? So number 4 of the Marmikaimus, you have the Darkei Tshuva. The Darkei Tshuva is a collection of all of the Achreinim commenting on the Yoredeya. It was put together by the Munkacher Rebbe in Europe. He had a yeshiva, and he assigned each bacher to work on 2 pages of Yoredeya and to collect all of the commentaries, all of the Shadas Tshuvas, and then he put it all together. So the Darkei Tshuva quotes from the Sefer Mishkan Es Yankev The Minkacha was a Hungarian rabbi. He was famous for his anti-Zionist position. He was the leader of the anti-Zionist campaign in Europe. He didn't live so long to see the Second World War, didn't live so long to see Hakamas HaMedina, but he was tumbling against Zionism. So he quotes from the Mishkanes Yankov. Mishkanes Yankov was a Litvak. He was a student of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, the Volozhiner Yeshiva. So the Mishkanes Yankov says that Miotam Motzi is 10%. If there's a 10% chance that you're going to have bugs in this vegetable, then you'll have to check for the bugs. They have to be biting. What do you mean a 10% chance? It means how much does a normal person eat in a normal meal? If you eat a bowlful, so the question is there a 10% chance that you're going to find a bug in that bowlful? If you normally eat two bowls of vegetables, then there's going to be a higher likelihood. You have to multiply by two. It's a higher chance that you're going to eat a bug. So whenever there's a 10% chance, that's considered a miyot hamotzeh. This is the opinion of the Mishkanes Yankov. In recent years, Rabbi Yashiv disagreed with the Mishkanes Yankov. He thought that miyot hamotzeh is 7%. Where did he get that from, 7%? So he said that in Eretz Yisrael in recent years, in slaughterhouses, where they shecht, and it's a business, so they keep records of how often does a certain shechet make an avela. If he slips too often and he makes nevelas, then they fire him. They don't need a sheikh that doesn't do a good job. And they keep track of how many animals have treifas, where did they buy the animals from, and how common was it that they have treifas. And if they're going to ascertain that from a certain farm they have a higher percentage of treifas, they're going to stop buying from that farm because they can't sell it for kosher. So in America, they've been keeping records for many years already. So many years ago, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to give a hashgacha on the slaughterhouse in Boston. He said at that time, the incidence of treifas, of sirchas on the lungs, used to be 14%. He was very upset. He said that he uses all the kulas on the books plus more. That's what he said. He uses all the kulas on the books plus more. And in his slaughterhouse, which was not glad kosher, they had 14% of sirchas on the lungs. And he said there used to be a glad kosher place, but they claimed they only had 9%. He said, that's impossible. How can it be 9%? Glad kosher means they're not makel. They're machmer on everything. How can it be that they're machmer on everything? That by him, he's makel on everything. Not 14%. He used to be upset. He used to say that the glad kosher is glad treif. You can't rely on the glad kosher. That was 70 years ago. 60, 70 years ago. So in America, the incidence of sirchas on the lungs is over 10%. In Eretz Yisrael, in recent years, they've been keeping records, and it's only 7%. So Rabbi Yashiv said this medrash that the Ramban quoted in number one of the Marmakaimus, that you only have to check for sirchas on the lungs, you don't have to check for the other. The medrash was probably written in Eretz Yisrael or the area in the medrash Tanchuma was written in Bavel, but it's probably the same percentage of sirchas that they had in Eretz Yisrael. So since in Eretz Yisrael, only 7% of all of the animals that they shecht have sirchas on the lungs, so Rabbi Yashiv taught that you have to be machma. Whenever there's a 7% chance that there may be bugs in your portion of vegetable that you're going to eat, then you should really be obligated mid rabbanon to be bedik to make sure that there are no bugs. This is relevant for shatnas as well. Is it necessary to check clothing for shatnas? So if the rove is, the likelihood is, whenever you bring your clothes into the shatnas man to be tested, shatnas person, whatever, whoever's doing the testing, if it's less than 10% of the clothing have shatnas, so strictly speaking, you don't have to be baidik. Either less than 7% or less than 10% if it's a meal chain of motzah. So sometimes they give us the percentages. They tell us that it's in certain kind of ties that come from Italy, certain kind of suits that come from Hungary, whatever, there's a higher percentage of shatnas. So then you're obligated the rabbana to check, even though the rove is, the likelihood is that it has no shatnas. But if there's a miyotam motzeh, then one is obligated to check. In New York, in America, there's a regulation. Okay. Sometimes it's only a collar, and sometimes it's in other parts of the men's suits as well. Most often it's in the collar, but that is correct. In America, there's a regulation that any city that has over a population of 10,000 is obligated to have a filter system to filter all the bugs out of the water. So the three cities in America that have way over 10,000 population, that do not filter the water. New York City is one of the three lucky winners. New York City, Boston, and Seattle. That's how they wrote up in the New York Times. These are the three big cities that have over 10,000. Not so big, 10,000. And they don't filter the water. So the Maharam Shik, who was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, lived in Hungary. Maharam Shik writes in his Tshuvas that every body of water has these copepods. These copepods are not really visible to the naked eye. They're translucent, and it's hard to see them. But if they would bring... if they would bring you a bucket of water from the reservoir in New York City, I remember they brought us a bucket of water to the yeshiva, so you can see the thing swimming around like in a fish tank. It's obvious that there's something swimming around over there. You can't see the bugs themselves because they're translucent, but you can see them swimming around. So Tosfos writes in Erevin that the reason why the Chumash calls these animals, these insects, sherets, is because b'shor sherots, when the animal runs, then it's visible. Even if the animal is not running, it's not, you can't recognize it as a bug. But if it runs around, if it swims around, then you can see that there's something there. That's considered visible to the naked eye. So the Maharam Shik writes that every body of water in the world has these copepods. And he writes that usually when you draw water, years ago they didn't have pipe systems, so they used to lower buckets into the water. So if you have a deep river and you lower a bucket into the water, so it's not necessary to load all the way to the bottom. So they would take water from the top of the river. So usually the copepods are the bottom of the river. So the Maharam Shik writes that in most communities, the incidence of having these copepods is so low, it's a mere chain of mortar. It's going to be less than 10%, less than 7%. You don't have to worry about it. But he's writing to someone who lives in a community where the incidence of copepods is higher than that. It's a miyutam motzi. So he says, then in your community, you're obligated to filter the water mid the rabbanon. Even though the rove is, you're probably not going to swallow one of these bugs. But mid the rabbanon, one is obligated to filter the water if you have a miyutam motzi. Why is it that all of a sudden now, for so many generations, for so many centuries, it was only a miyutam motzi? And how come in New York... it's a miyutam motzi that you find the copepods. So they explain why, because these copepods usually stay on the bottom of the river. And now in New York, we don't lower buckets into the top of the river. We have a pipe system, so the pipes are on the bottom of the river. So that's why there's a higher percentage of these copepods. The question is, by the time the water reaches us in our kitchen, so the water has been shooting at a tremendous force, going very quickly in many different pipes. And these copepods, if you take a bucket of water from the reservoir, you can see these copepods swimming around like in a fish tank. But by the time the water reaches our kitchen, all the copepods are dead already, because the water shoots with such a force, and they all get killed by banging into one pipe or another, for the time it reaches from the reservoir to our home. So by the time we get it, they're not swimming around anymore, they're all dead. So that's a question. Is that considered a sheretz, which is nira l'ayin? Because originally, when it was in the reservoir, it was nira l'ayin. It was easily detectable. You can see that there are things swimming around there. It's obviously not the wind blowing, because they're swimming back and forth. But by the time we get the water, it's not nira l'ayin. So that's a question. Is that considered nira l'ayin? So the Darkei Tshuva again quotes on that simon by the Toiloim. He quotes Achrayim who say that is considered nira l'ayin. Even though right now, they're not able to swim around. They're all dead and it's not visible. He discusses a different situation. That you have, there was some Rabbonim who thought that you're not allowed to drink any alcohol, because every alcohol has tiny, invisible, microscopic animals that are only visible through a microscope. It's not visible to the naked eye. So Moshe Feinstein writes that that's ridiculous. It says in the Chumash that one is permitted to drink alcohol. A Nazir is not permitted to drink wine that turned into alcohol. Wine or grape juice or alcohol from the grape juice. But anyone else other than a Nazir is permitted to, even though we know that there are microscopic animals that are converting the wine into alcohol. So whatever is not visible to the naked eye is muta. But the question is, let's say you have a sheretz, let's say you have a vegetable, a leaf, and you have a black spot on the leaf. So if you hold the leaf on your hand, so the black spot may start to move, because it'll be annoyed by the warmth of the body temperature. if you're gonna cook, let's say you're gonna cook this vegetable, so all of the bugs are gonna be dead, so they won't be moving. We won't be able to notice them. But originally you were able to notice them. They weren't visible to the naked eye. So that's a question. So the Darkei Tshuva quotes those who say that that sosa, since originally it wasn't visible to the naked eye, even though now it's dead, that's considered a sheretz, and you're not allowed to eat it. And others don't accept that chumrah from the Darkei Tshuva. Number five is a quotation from a Rashi and Gemara Chulin. The Gemara Chulin points out that the Chumash tells us how to identify a kosher fish if it has fins and scales. How to identify a kosher animal if it's malager, mafis, parsif, has split hoofs, and it chews its cud. How do you identify which birds are kosher? So the Chumash doesn't tell us any simonim. The Chumash gives you a list of the non-kosher birds, and every other bird that's not on the list is kosher. That's the rule. But the Mishnayos and the Gemara tell you the klolim. How can you, if you don't know which the birds are that the Chumash is listing off, so I don't know which bird is kosher, which bird is treif. So the Gemara gives you simonim how to identify. So in the days of the Amoraim, there was a new bird in Bavel that they never heard of before, and they checked based on the simonim, and they determined, they established that this is a kosher bird, so they were eating it. And then after a while, after a couple of months of eating it, they realized that they misjudged, they made a mistake, and this was a non-kosher bird. So Rashi writes on that. The Gemara tells the story. So Rashi writes on the Gemara, you see that the Amoraim were not experts. They were not bekiyim to determine which birds are kosher, which birds are treif. So Rashi recommends it's a good idea. That's number five in the Marmakayim. It's mitoch she'ein on a bekiyim. But hey, we're not sure exactly how to apply these simonim to determine which birds are kosher, which are treif. So he recommends we shouldn't eat any birds unless we have a tradition that it's a kosher bird, even if it corresponds to all of the simonim in the Gemara and in the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah quotes to number six. It starts off with the word Hagoh. Hagoh means it's an addition added on by the Ramah. So the Ramah follows Rashi. The Ramah quotes it from the Sefer Issa V'Heter Ha'Oruch. Issa V'Heter is by Rabbeinu Yoinu Ha'Ashkenazi. There were two Rabbeinu Yoinus. There was a more famous Rabbeinu Yoinu HaSfardi, who was a Mechutin of the Ramban. And he wrote the Shari Tshuvin, he wrote the commentary on the Rif and Brochus, and this is Barabbeinu Yoinu Ashkenazi, not to be confused, on the first page in this Sefer Issa V'Heter in Europe, and he used to print it, he used to misidentify it. He wrote, this is Barabbeinu Yoinu, the famous Rabbeinu Yoinu, the two different Rabbeinu Yoinus. So Rabbeinu Yoinu in the Sefer Issa V'Heter always follows the traditions of Rashi and Taisvis. He never quotes any Sfarad Shachrayim at all. It's all from Ashkenazi. So the Ramah for Ashkenazim quotes this Rashi, that we shouldn't eat any new bird unless we have a tradition that the bird is kosher. It was a big issue when Columbus discovered America and he came back to Spain and he brought with him the turkey. So the Jews in Europe never had a tradition on the turkey that it's kosher. The turkey has all the simonim of being a kosher bird, but we had no tradition on it. And the recommendation of the of Rashi that's followed by the Ashkenazim is that we don't eat any new bird unless we have a tradition that it's kosher. But he went back to Spain. He didn't go to Ashkenaz. He didn't go to Poland. He went back to Spain. So the Sfardim don't have this tradition. This is a tradition by Ashkenazim because Rashi recommended like that. And the Ramah was written by Ashkenazim for Ashkenazim. So the Sfardim didn't have such a tradition. So when he brought back the turkey to Spain, so all the Sfardim were eating the turkey. And after 50 years, the Ashkenazim saw, the Jews in Spain are eating the turkey. So they said they must have had a tradition that it's kosher. They never had a tradition. He brought it back from the New World, and everybody started eating turkey. So years later, they woke up and they realized that the turkey came in through the back door over here, that there never was a tradition on the turkey. So many of the rabbanim were tumbling that you're not allowed to eat turkey. Ashkenazim shouldn't eat turkey because we don't have a tradition. So they say the Baal Shem Tov got upset. You shouldn't be Malamit Chayvan Klal Yisrael. There's nothing wrong with the turkey. The turkey is kosher. So by the Hasidim, they accepted the turkey. There was no problem. But by the Misnagdim, some of them were opposed. The Shaloh was one of the Gedolim at that time. Shaloh lived in the 1500s. So the Shaloh was one of those who prohibited the eating of the turkey because we have no tradition. One of the rabbis in Yeshiva, Rabbi Horowitz, is a descendant of the Shaloh. Shaloh's family name was Horowitz. So he says he has cousins, he has relatives. They eat chazer on Yom Kippur, but they won't eat turkey. because they have a tradition for Neshalot, you don't eat turkey. So that's the issue with the turkey. Number seven, in the Shulchan Aruch, they tell you, based on Pesukim Chumash, based on Gemara, that there is a difference between a behema and a chaya. A behema, the certain parts of the fats are osir, it's a prohibition of chaylev. And in a chaya, you can eat everything. There's no prohibition of chaylev. You don't have to trade with the flesh, you don't have to remove the chaylev. Another difference is, you're not allowed to shech the behema osavez beno on the same day, but if an animal is a chaya, you are permitted to shech the osavez beno. The Gemara has several differences between a behema and a chaya. Let's say a deer is a chaya, and a cow is a behema. Now, how do you tell whether it's a behema, or how do you determine? So the Shulchan Aruch says, it depends on the shape of the horns. You have to know animals well in order to determine whether something is behema or a chaya. So the Shach writes in number 8 of the Maamkam. Shach is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. So the Shach says that since we are not so bucky about checking the horns to determine which animal is a behema, which animal is a chaya, so the proper practice should be you should only permit the eating of the chaylev, the exact same chaylev, the exact same fatty part. And a chaya is mutter, and the behemoth is an isa kares. So one should not eat chaylev of a chaya unless we have a tradition that this animal is a chaya as opposed to a behemoth. That's why the Shach writes. The Shach lived in Vilna. When you go touring in Eastern Europe and you go visit Vilna, so they only talk about the Vilna Goyim. They never talk about the Shach. The Shach was more prominent than the Vilna Goyim. The Shach is quoted much more often in Tshuva Svarim than the Vilna Goyim is quoted. But somehow they forgot about him. So the Shach writes in his commentary that the minig in Vilna is that we only eat the chaylev of an animal if we have a tradition that this animal is a chay. We don't rely on our bedikah, on our checking of the horns. The Chochma Sodom was a businessman who lived in Vilna. He was a mechutna of the Vilna Goyen. Shach lived in the 1600s. The Chochma Sodom lived in the late 1700s. So the Chochma Sodom, who lived in Vilna, writes that the meaning of Vilna is we don't eat any animal. He doesn't talk about eating the chaylev of an animal. We don't shecht any animal unless we have a tradition that this animal is a kosher animal. We don't want to rely on our judging that it's malagera mafis paris. What's so difficult to determine whether an animal has split hoofs? You look to see. What's so difficult to see if it's chewing its cud? That's what the Chochma Sodom writes. There are those who say that the Chochma Sodom made a mistake, that he's basing himself on the Shach. The Shach never said that. The Shach says, we don't rely on Bedika Simonim to establish that an animal is a chai as opposed to behemoth to be permitted to eat a chaylev, but to be permitted to shech the animal to eat it. Why not? The Shach never said that. But it's hard to say the Chochma Sodom made a mistake. He's telling what the tradition is during his lifetime. He lived 100 years after the Shach. He says the meaning of Vilna was that they wouldn't shecht any new animal unless they had a tradition that this animal was a malagera mafis paris. Why do you have to have a tradition? What's so difficult? So it's interesting. There is a pasuk in Chumash in Parshas Re'eh when the Torah gives the list of all the kosher animals, which fish are kosher, which animals are kosher, and so on. So the Chumash says shesua. Shesua is a non-kosher animal you're not allowed to eat. What in the world is a shesua? So the Gemara says, on the top line in number 10, shesua is an animal b'riya, sheyesh la shnei gabin shnei shadros. It has two spines. It has a crack in the middle, and has two spines parallel to each other that join. So the Gemara has a machlokes, Rabbi Shmuel, does such an animal exist? Maybe such an animal can't exist. The Hakna Chumash talk about a non-existent animal. So one of the opinions in the Gemara is no, such an animal would die. It wouldn't be able to live. The Chumash is talking about a ben pekua shesua. Ben pekua means if I shecht an animal, this apparently is more common. If you shecht a cow and it's pregnant, so the din is that the shechita on the mother is chal on the uber inside, and there's no need for shechita on ben pekua. Min ha-Torah. With the Rabbanim, Mishnah Marisan, you have to shecht a ben pekua as well. But in Atara, there's no need for shechting the ben pekua. So this is fairly common. It's not that unusual that you have a ben pekua shesua. So one of the opinions in the Gemara is that the Chumash must be talking about Ben Pekul, who's a Shesua. Can't be talking about an animal that's running around in the jungle that's a Shesua. Such an animal couldn't possibly survive because it has two spines. And the other opinion is no. Such an animal can survive. The Chumash is talking about a normal Shesua. And if you have the Ben Pekul Shesua, that would be permissible. So in the Shulchan Aruch, because of the suffix number 11 of the Mar Mekaymes, in the Shulchan Aruch they paskin that Ben Pekua Shesua is also, because we assume that such an animal cannot exist. So the Torah Tamima writes in his commentary, Torah Tamima was written in the early 1900s, so he writes, he's very surprised, he read in a book on biology that in Brazil such an animal does exist with two spines, and its malagera and its mafis parasa has all the simanim of a kosher animal. So we should why don't we reverse the psak in the Shulchan Aruch? That's what he's bothered with the kasha. Why don't we reverse the psak? We see that such an animal does exist. It's malagera, mafis parasa, but because it has two spines, so that's what the Torah says, you're not allowed to eat it. But if it'll be a ben pekuah, you should be allowed to eat it. So why shouldn't we reverse the psak in the Shulchan Aruch? So it's interesting, the kasha that the Torah Tmima asked, he quotes it from earlier. It wasn't his kasha, he quotes it from earlier books. Experts on animals. So they thought for 100 years, maybe over 100 years, they thought that animal in the jungles in Brazil was a malagueira. And then they came to realization, they made a mistake around 20 years ago, they came to realization. They made a mistake for 100 years, the animal is not malagueira. If you chew chewing gum all the time, that's not called malagueira. Malagueira means the food goes down to the stomach and then it comes back up, and the animal chews, it goes down again, then it comes back up. This animal in jungles is always chewing on food. That's not called malagueira. We jokingly call someone who eats chewing gum, we call him a malagueira. But that's not what a malagueira. Malagueira means that the food goes to the stomach, that it comes back up. So they did make a mistake. All the zoologists of the world made a mistake in misidentifying an animal. So maybe that's what the Chochmas Sodom says, that we have a tradition, a minik in Vilna, that you don't eat any animal. Not talking about not eating the chelav of the animal. You don't shecht any animal unless you have a tradition. This is a kosher animal. In the early years after Hakamas HaMedina, there was a correspondence between Rav Herzog, who was at that time the chief rabbi in the Chazon Ish. There is an animal that's called the zebu. The zebu gives off milk. Milk doesn't taste as good as milk from a cow. But the zebu has a hump on the back. It's malagueira, mafis parasa, has a hump on the back, looks a little like a camel. and it has the mila of a camel that it can hold water for a longer period of time. And in the Middle East, where it's pretty warm all the time, even the winter is pretty warm now, so that's a mila for an animal. So after many years of experimentation, that was done by non-Jews, we're not allowed to do this, they were making a hybrid between the zebu and the cow, and they came to the realization, if you have 3/8 of a zebu and 5/8 of a cow, or the reverse, I forgot already, 3/8 and 5/8, it'll have the milas of both. The milk will taste delicious like regular milk from a cow, and it'll have the mila that it doesn't have to drink so much water. It doesn't get so thirsty. It holds the water for a longer period of time. So for many years, there was no shechita in Eretz Yisrael, so we used to import geshochten meat from Argentina. They used to send rabbanim to Argentina. Rabbi Neuwirth, the author of Nishmeir Shabbos Kol Chosa, for a while, for quite a while, used to go to South America to supervise the shechita there. In fact, he mentioned to us on one occasion that there the incidence of sirchas on the lungs is 5%. Not like in America, it's way over 10%. Not like in Eretz Yisrael, that Rav Yashub said it's 7%. He said that in South America, it's only 5% have sirchas on the lungs. But he doesn't think we have to be machmir to say that anything above 5% is considered a amir tamotze with respect to the bugs and so on. So the Israeli government was interested in having a lot of milk farms, dairy farms, where they would have these zebus, because it gives off milk that originally, before they realized that you make the hybrid, it'll taste just like cow's milk, so it'll have the mila that it won't have to drink water so much, and it'll give off milk. So the Chazon Ish said that it's not a good idea, we shouldn't permit it, because many of the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael are Litvaks, and the Litvaks have the minhagim from Vilna, mentioned by the Chachmas Sodom. The Litvak treat the Chayyadim and the Chachmas Sodom like the Bible. Whatever it says there, they follow. The Galatianer with the Polish with the Ungarish, and not necessarily, but the Litvaks do. So the Chazon Ish said, you can't do that. If you're going to introduce the Zibu milk in Eretz Yisrael, so all the Litvaks will be prohibited from drinking it because of this minhag, that in Vilna they wouldn't eat any animal and they wouldn't drink the milk from any animal unless we have a tradition that the animal is kosher. Even though we see that it is malagerim of his parsa, you shouldn't do that. So for many years they didn't do it. They didn't do it. But then they came to the realization when they were breeding these two together, the cows with the zebu, and they came to the realization that the two can breed together and they can give off vladas. So the Gemara says in B'chorus, in the first parak, that a kosher animal cannot be breeded with a non-kosher animal. So if you have a tradition that a cow is kosher, and you can breed the cow with the zebu, and they're going to have ladas, so then the tradition that we have on the cow carries over to the zebu. So now it's accepted that the zebu is a kosher animal. But at that time, it wasn't known yet. So Rav Herzog at that time was corresponding with the Chazon Ish, who already lived in Eretz Yisrael at that time. He came to Eretz Yisrael before the Second World War. So Rav Herzog said that the Jews from India have a tradition that this zebu is a kosher animal. So Chazon Ish wrote back that a tradition has to be a practice that's approved by the Rabbanan, by Talmid HaChachamim. And in India, apparently, for many generations, there were no Talmid HaChachamim. So Rav Herzog agreed with him. He said, you're right. And they didn't allow the zebu. But after many years, and they came to the realization the two can be breeded together, so then they assumed that the tradition that we have on the cows carries over to the zebu. Regarding fish, the din clearly is, pardon me? Zebu, Z-E-B-U, I think. Yeah, it's assumed that it's kosher. Yeah. For many years, they were shechting the zebu in Argentina, and they were using the hides to write Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah. And the Gemara says you cannot write Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah on the hides of a non-kosher animal. So if you really say you're not sure if it's kosher, then you can't write mezuzahs or tefillin on these. So about 10 years ago, there was a whole explosion in Eretz Yisrael, a whole tumult on an Erev Shabbos in Bnei Brak. Everybody ready prepared their cholent, and some of the rabbanim said nobody should eat their flesh because they came to the realization that the kosher butcher stores in Bnei Brak were selling zebu. And then the rabbanim from the rabbanut said, what are you talking about? All of your tefillin, all of the sefer Torah, all the mezuzahs, everything is written on the zebu skin. You're off your mind. Everything that they were claiming, the Chazon Ish said so many years ago that you shouldn't eat zebu. He said, yeah, that was ancient history. But by now we know that the zebu is kosher because they breed it together. You're not allowed to breed it. But they were breeding it together with the cows, and it gave off a lot of, so the tradition that you have on the cow carries over to the zebu. So that was the end of the whole machlokes. No. It looks like a cow, but it has a hump. The sheichet, when he shechts it, doesn't look at the humps. Good? Okay. Regarding fish, the turkey can also mate with chickens and give off ladas. Yeah, the same as the zebu. Since the zebu can mate with cows, the only thing is that the turkey with the chickens on their own won't mate. I think they use artificial insemination. The zebu and the cow mate on their own. But the turkey and the chicken, they have to use artificial insemination, but it does give birth. So most of the Rabbanim assume that for the purposes of this Chumrah, the turkey has all the simanim of a kosher bird. And the Chumrah, not to use it, doesn't apply because we know that they can have a vlad together. Even though naturally they won't mate, there are many Rabbanim who don't eat it. As Rabbi Horowitz says, he has a cousin who will eat chazer on Yom Kippur, but he won't eat turkey. Yes. Regarding fish, it's impossible to require a masorah on fish. There are tens of thousands of kinds of fish in the world. It's not possible to have a masorah. The din is you have to have snapa v'kaskeses. You have to have fins and scales, and then it's kosher. But it has to look, so some Rishonim were of the opinion that it has to look like a fish. In the writings of the Bali HaTosfos, you see that in number 13, Beis Yosef is the commentary of Rav Yosef Karo on the Shulchan Aruch, on the tour. So Rav Yosef Karo quotes from the Sefer Samach Mem Kuf. It's called Sefer Mitzvahs Katan. There's a Sefer Mitzvahs Gadol, and there's another Sefer Mitzvahs Katan. Just like the Rambam wrote a Sefer Mitzvahs, where he lists off what, in his opinion, are the 613 mitzvahs. So the Bali HaTosfos also wrote there's a Sefer Mitzvahs Gadol and a Sefer Mitzvahs Katan. So in the Smat, the Sefer Mitzvahs Katan, he writes that there was a big debate regarding the Barbuta. We don't know exactly what fish that's supposed to be. It's a French name. What fish are they talking about? So the quote, Rabbi Yehuda Chosid said that you're not allowed to eat the Barbuta. No, they said it is permissible. What's the issue with the Barbuta? So these Bali HaTosfos were of the opinion that in order for a fish to be kosher, with simonim of the fish, malager, mafis parsa, it has to have the shape of a fish. What's the shape of a fish? So the tail has to be indented. If the tail is not indented, like a V, then it's not a fish. What if you have an animal that's a sea animal that has fins and scales and has hands and legs also? It doesn't look like a fish. It's an animal of the sea. It doesn't look like a fish. So these Rishonim are of the opinion that it's not kosher, with the snapa v'kaskeses, has to have the shape of a fish, and part of the shape of the fish is that it has to have a tail that's split. And the Sefer Mitzvahs Katan quotes that this was a big machlokes, and accepted opinion is that it doesn't have to be. We eat the tilapia, and we eat the soles, we eat a lot of fish that have snapa v'kaskeses, and the tail is not indented. So that's we don't paskin like that. The question is, what if you have a sea animal? It doesn't have the shape of a fish at all. It has hands and legs, and it looks like a horse or something. And also happens to have snapa v'kaskeses. So that's a further machlokes. Maybe it has to have the shape of a fish. Maybe the split tail is not part of the definition of a shape of a fish, but maybe it does have to have the shape of a fish. So that's a further discussion. The Ramban in his commentary on Chumash writes on the word kaskeses that the scales have to be such that if you take a knife and you scrape in one direction, all the scales will be removed. What if the scales are attached on both sides? And the only way to get them off is by prying them off, by yanking them out. So the Ramban thinks that by definition that's not considered a kaskeses. The Magid Mishnah is a commentary on the Rambam, and the Beis Yosef is by Rabbi Yosef Karo. So Rabbi Yosef Karo, number 14, quotes the Magid Mishnah, who quotes this from the Ramban in his commentary on Chumash and Vayikra, middle of Vayikra, that this is awesome. So this is the issue with the sturgeon. The sturgeon has fins and scales, but the scales are such that they're attached on both sides and you can't scrape off the scales by going in one direction. So some Rabbanim thought, who says we have to paskin like the Ramban? Everything the Ramban says is accepted, halacha l'maisa. Maybe we don't necessarily have to follow the Ramban. And then Rabbi Yehuda, who lived in the 1700s, he was the rabbi in Prague, he's one of the major paskim. He was a cousin of the Baal Shem Tov. They lived for a while in the same village and they had friction. He was anti-Hasidus. He was a big misnagid. So the Nadi Behuda was once lenient on a certain kind of a fish. Even though it was difficult to remove the scales, he was lenient. So in Hungary, in number 16 in the Marmakomis, the Malamid Lahoyal is by the Tshuva Sefer of Rav David Zvi Hoffman, same one who wrote all the books against biblical criticism in Germany. He was in Hildesheim Seminary in Berlin. He was a Talmud of Maram Shik. He was from Hungary, but then he was in Berlin at Hildesheim Seminary. So he writes that in Hungary, at the beginning of the Reform Movement, the whole Reform Movement was begun by Orthodox rabbis. And one of the Orthodox rabbis was named Aaron Harina. So he started off, he paskened that the sturgeon is kosher. And everybody disagreed with him. And later on, he turned out, he developed his opinions on other things, and he was one of the leaders of the Reform Movement. And he used to sign his name Aaron Harina Rabina. So they used to call him Acher in the days of the Tanoim. Elisha ben Avuya was known as Acher because he became an Abdikaris. He was a Tana, he was the Rebbe of Rab Meir, so he became an Abdikaris. He was known as Acher. So the Rosh HaTeva said, Aaron Harina Rabina is Acher. So they, after he became a Reformed Rabbi, they said, we knew all along he was rotten, he was no good, because he said the sturgeon is kosher, and it's not so. So there's history to the sturgeon. There's an issue whether the sturgeon is really treif. It's all based on the Ramban's Chiddush and his commentary on Chumash. But the Ramban's Chiddush is accepted lahalacha. It's quoted by the Beis Yosef from the Magen Mishnah. It's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. So that's why we don't eat the sturgeon. Question is, what about swordfish? So swordfish has fins and scales. The scales of the swordfish are not the same as regular scales. But the Shulchan Aruch writes, it doesn't matter what shape, how big they are, how small they are, as long as they're visible to the naked eye. So years ago, one of the Orthodox rabbis made a whole tumult, 60 years ago, I guess, about the swordfish, that it's not kosher. And the Achronim write, befeirush, that the dag hacherev, that's how they called it in Hebrew, the swordfish, the dag hacherev is kosher. So one of the rabbis said, that's not referring to the swordfish, it's referring to something else. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asked a professor, Shlomo Sternberg, he used to be here, he used to learn here in the yeshiva. Where is he now? He's somewhere in Massachusetts, in one of the universities, a big genius, a math genius, I think. So he asked them to look into it, and he published an essay, Sternberg published an essay in the Bar Ilan publication that's called BDD, B'chol D'Rachecha D'Ehu. They have an English section and a Hebrew section. They wrote this up in English. The Rabbi Soloveitchik asked him to check into it, and he removed all the scales from the swordfish and he showed it to Rabbi Soloveitchik and he said, so it's a kosher fish, so what's the problem? There's nothing to discuss. So he writes in his essay that he still has the envelope with the scales in his Gemara Chulin. Whoever wants to see the scales that Rabbi Soloveitchik said a kosher is welcome to come to his home and show you the scales. In Eretz Yisrael there are restaurants where they'll serve swordfish upon request. So the Americans say, what do you mean swordfish is treif? Yeah, because years ago this rabbi in America made such a tumult, swordfish is treif. But the Pashtus is that the swordfish is kosher. In South Africa they have a fish that's the king clip. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that it's okay. Yes. You don't have to eat swordfish. Some people don't want to eat too, don't eat it. But strictly speaking, there's no halacha what shape the scales have to be. Any shape is acceptable. The king clip in South Africa, they eat king clip. This was the psak of Rabbi Chaim Moses' brother-in-law, who was a rabbi in South Africa. So he paskin that the king clip is kosher. The king clip has fins and scales, but the scales are so soft, it's just like, it doesn't really protect, it's like another layer of skin. So it doesn't really protect the fish from the water. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah talks about the scales on a fish, that the kosher fish have the ability to swim against the tide, against the flow of the river. The Jews are kosher, so we swim against the tide. So the Gemara says the scales are in order to protect the fish when it's going to be swimming against the tide. So what if it has scales that are so soft? Usually the scales are like plastic. What if the scales are so soft? It's just like another layer of skin. So that's questionable. So that's why over the last 80 years, since Rabbi Chaim Moses' brother-in-law lived in South Africa, he said the king clip is kosher, every 20 years somebody tumult that maybe it's not kosher. But there are the bezin does eat it. The bezin paskin that the king clip is kosher, so they do eat it there. In the Shmir Shabski Hilchasa, number 18 of the Marmakaimus, in a footnote, this is from the previous edition. It's not in the recent edition. It's going to be somewhere else. I don't have a copy of the recent edition, but this is in the previous edition. So he quotes that sheretz to be osa bachila has to be near a line, has to be visible to the naked eye. If you can only see it, if you look under a magnifying glass or you look under a microscope or something, so that's permissible. So what if you have a speck, you have a vegetable that has a speck, and the speck looks like a black spot of dirt or something, or maybe part of the vegetable. You don't see it crawling, you don't see it moving, you don't see any legs. It's not visible to the, it's visible to the naked eye that there's a black speck there, but it's not, you cannot identify it as a bug. So is that considered visible to the naked eye? And that's where Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said the pashtus is that it's mutter. That's not called near lie. Near lie means it's visible and you can identify it as a bug. And he was surprised, Reb Shlomo Zalman said, he was surprised to hear that in the home of the Chazanish, they would be makbid not to eat such vegetables that have such bugs, which are only, you can see the black spot, but you can't detect, you can't identify that it's a bug without a magnifying glass or without a microscope. So Reb Shlomo Zalman thought that should really be permissible. Just 2 months ago, they started a whole turmoil about Tropicana orange juice. They say apparently the way the different companies squeeze out the juice, the different companies have a different system. So Tropicana is the lucky winner. They have more bugs in their orange juice than the others. So the question is, are the bugs awesome? So one of the rabbanim went down to Florida and he made a whole study. The pashtus is the bugs, while they're alive, before you kill them, bugs while alive cannot be detected. You can see a black spot, but there are black spots on top of the orange on the outside. All the time there are black spots. You can't identify it as a bug without a magnifying glass. Yeah? Right, Russ said, so they have the different orange juice companies have a different system of how to get the juice out. So Tropicana has a system where they get even the juice from the peel. So that's why they have a higher incidence of these bugs, much higher incidence than the other juice companies. So that's what some of the rabbanim in Lakewood raised an issue. You shouldn't be allowed to drink Tropicana because it's a neotamotze. In every cup of oranges, you're going to have bugs, at least 8 bugs, something like that. Yeah, but the question is, the bugs, while they're alive, they hardly move at all. You can hardly detect. If you'll take, they took a video of the bug for several hours. So if you watch the video for a few hours, you see that the bug moved a little bit. But you have to sit and watch for a few hours. That's not considered near a lie. Near a lie means I see the thing is moving. I see the thing is moving. But you can't detect that it's a bug with the naked eye. So the pashtus is that the bug, those bugs that really move, that's considered not near a lie. Not necessarily. No, you don't have to assume that it's a bug, but sometimes the lettuce, sometimes you have to check, but it depends. You see, Bodek is a company, they don't have any secret, they don't have a new magical system to clean out all the bugs. They just surveyed the whole United States. So they found that in certain areas, at certain seasons of the year, every company has their own cleaning process. In certain companies, certain seasons of the year, there are hardly any bugs, so it'll be a meal chain of mutzen. It'll be less than 10%, even less than 7% that likelihood that you find a bug. So they'll give their approval. They didn't figure out any new system. They just say the system that they have here in the springtime on these vegetables, that's a good system, and therefore that's a meal chain of mutzen. So that's what we have to, any fruit or vegetable that you want to eat, you have to make sure that there's a meal chain of matzah, your bugs. Now they all have bugs, everything has bugs, because the government prohibited the use of the pesticides. Just a word about caviar. Just like if you have a non-kosher animal that gives off milk, or if you have a non-kosher bird that lays eggs, so you're not permitted to drink the milk of a pig, you're not permitted to eat the eagle's eggs. So too if you have fish that are non-kosher fish that lay eggs, there are non-kosher fish, so non-kosher fish that lays eggs, so the eggs may not be eaten either. The same pasuk that prohibits the use of the milk, eating the milk and the eggs from the non-kosher animals or birds, also prohibits the eating of the eggs from the non-kosher fish. So the Shulchan Aruch writes a tradition that it depends what color the eggs are. That if the eggs are red, then somehow the Rishonim had a tradition that it must be from a kosher fish. If the eggs are black, if the caviar is black, that it could be kosher, it could be trick. But some of the black eggs come from kosher fish, some come from non-kosher fish. This is what they had a tradition, that if it's red, it's kosher. Now it's a problem because the caviar companies want to make money, so they'll buy eggs and they'll dye them red. So people, because people will they would prefer to have the red eggs. So you have to make sure that you have caviar under a hashgacha. I want to say a little bit about DE, about dairy equipment, very different from the rest of the talk. If you have some food that was cooked with milk or cheese, that's milchik, so we're not permitted to eat. We have a mini, we don't have milchiks when we're fleshik, 6 hours after we have fleshiks. What if you have something that was cooked in a milchik pot, but it doesn't have any milchik ingredients? So the Gemara calls that noisin tam, bar noisin tam. In Shulchan Aruch, that's known by the Rashi Tevis, nun tes, not bar not, noisin tam, bar noisin tam. Means like this: I cooked milk in a pot, and I cleaned out the pot, and I ate up the milchik meichel. So the pot has a blia of milchiks in it. Now I cook potatoes in the pot, and no milk in the potatoes. But the potatoes were cooked in the pot within 24 hours after my having cooked the milk in the pot. So the potatoes have a blia from the pot, which had a blia from the milk. So that's called a nice and tam, nice and tam. The potatoes, the power of the potatoes, have a blia from the pot, which in turn got a blia from the milk. So the Gemara says a nice and tam, my nice and tam is parva. There's no problem. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, that's the din, it's muta. Rabbi Yosef Kara writes for the Svardim, it's muta, no problem. The Ramah, usually the Ashkenazim are more machmer than the Svardim. The Ramah wrote for the Ashkenazim, so a lot of times the Shulchan Aruch says that this is muta, so the Ramah says the Ashkenazim don't need it. Usually the Ashkenazim are more machmer. There's one area where the Svardim are more machmer than the Ashkenazim, that's on glatt kosher flesh. When you have when you shecht an animal and you find a sircha on the lung, you find an adhesion on the lung, so the Sfardim say if it comes off very easily, just rub it off and it comes off 1, 2, 3, then that's not called a sircha. It does make the animal trade. The Ashkenazim are lenient. In Europe this was more relevant than it is in America. So if you would have a sircha on the lung and you would rub and rub and rub and rub till you would, a lot of times you've got to yank off the sircha, it'll make a hole in the lung. So you don't know whether the hole was caused now or the hole was there while the animal was alive. So you used to rub and rub and rub, because if it'll be a trey for them, they'll lose a fortune of money. So you used to do al yedei miyuch mishmash, they rub so long till the sircha would peel off, and then they would blow up the lung and put it under water to see if bubbles would come up. If no bubbles come up, that's an indication that this sircha didn't indicate that there was a hole in the. So that's a kula that the Ramah has. And the Sfardim don't rely on that kula. So that's called glatt kosher. Glatt kosher means that the lung was smooth. Glatt means that it was smooth. They didn't practice miyuch mishpush. Even the Sfardim on Mekel, if it comes off very easily, is to can't, then you rub a little bit and the whole sircha comes off, 1, 2, 3. So that's not considered a sircha. So that's the one kula that the Ramah has, that in the history books they say that one kula outweighs all of the chumras that the Ramah had. The Ramah has many chumras. So this is one of the many chumras that the Ramah has. If you cook potatoes in a pot, which is a milchik pot, since the pot is hot and the potatoes hot, everything is hot, that doesn't have the kula, doesn't have the leniency of noisin tam bar noisin tam. When is there a din of not by not? Dogim sha'olu b'kaira. Let's say I have a fleshik plate that's cold, and I just fried fish, parva fish. I take the parva fish and I put it on the fleshik plate. So the plate is cold and the fish is hot. So if one is hot, one is cold, there will be a blia. There'll be a slight blia of the fleshik blia will go into the fish. So then we have the kula that nois and tam remains parva. But if I cooked it not banat al yedei bishul, if you cooked the potatoes in the milchik pot, then the Ramah is machmer for Ashkenazim, then the potatoes are considered milchik. To what extent are considered milchik? Let's say I cook the potatoes in a fleshik pot. You have to wait 6 hours. You don't become fleshik. Let's say you have a fleshik pot where you cooked some chicken, and then you didn't clean it out. You have a little schmaltz over there, and then you cook. Then you fry potatoes in that pot. You're not really interested in the flavor of the schmaltz going into the potatoes. You just want to fry the potatoes. You don't want to waste your time to wash out the frying pan in between. So that says in Shulchan Aruch that you don't become fleshy. You don't have to wait 6 hours after having such fried potatoes. If let's say they made a potato kugel, and they put in schmaltz on purpose because they wanted to have the flavor of the schmaltz, so then we consider the potato kugel as being fleshy because they put in the schmaltz on purpose. But they just didn't want to bother to wash out the pot in between, even though there's the same percentage of schmaltz in the pot. That's not considered flesh, except for that you don't have to wait 6 hours. So let's say you have, let's say we just said you have, you baked Oreo cookies, whatever, on the same baking tin that they baked milchik cookies. So it's in the same day, they keep on baking, there's hardly any pause in between the parva and the milchik. There's no milchik ingredients in the Oreo cookies, there are a lot of products like that, but that's made with dairy equipment. So that's really, for Spartan, not considered nois hamar, nois entam, even though the thing was baked on it. Even though they're both hot, the pot is hot and the cookies are, everything is baked, everything is hot. So for Sfardim, that's considered paravim, and it's not considered milchik, and they can have it together with flesh. And for Ashkenazim, we're machmer that if it was baked on dairy equipment within 24 hours of having done the milchiks, so we treat it as being milchik with respect to that you're not allowed to eat it together with the flesh. Sometimes little children, you have to coax them to eat their chicken or their flesh, so you give them cookies while they're eating the flesh at the same time. Usually by adults it never happens. Usually adults, they don't begin to have the cake or the cookies till after the whole meal is all over, so they're not eating flesh at the same time. So then the chumrah doesn't apply. You don't have to wait 6 hours in order to eat the cookies, but you shouldn't eat the cookies together with the flesh. So that's the din of not by not, that Ashkenazim amachmer, if it's nice and tam by nice and tam, are they bishul, where they're both burning out. And Sfardim would be mekel. So the OU used to write O-U-D-E. And a lot of people complained, they didn't know what in the world DE meant. DE meant dairy equipment. So the OU discontinued it. They thought that they're confusing the public. So now if it's going to be dairy equipment, they're going to write that D. But many people will call up the office and find out, is it really milchik? Or is it just made on milchik equipment? If it's only made on milchik equipment, so strictly speaking, it is parava. It's just that you shouldn't have it together with the flesh. But you don't have to wait 6 hours in order to eat the cookies. You can eat the cookies at the end of the meal. Very good. Have a nice day.